O'Neill, good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Catherine O'Neill with King & Spalding for Holiday CVS doing business as stores 219 and 5195. We certainly acknowledge that DEA has an important role to play in curbing the abuse and diversion of controlled substances.
Before you get into the merits too much, can I just ask you your view of when this case is going to be moot?
We do not believe it will be moot for a significant period of time. We did receive yesterday afternoon the order that has not yet been published in the Federal Register. Under 824D, it's very clear that the immediate suspension order remains in place for the entire period of the proceedings, including any judicial review thereof. And so, therefore, once the order is published...
Now, at a point where the recent conclusion becomes legally effective, the legal significance of the ISO is nil. Isn't that right?
We do not believe so. It is a case where the order will become effective 30 days from when it is published, but we have an opportunity to appeal that. And right. It is the immediate suspension order and not that revocation order, in our view, while it is on appeal, that would be precluding the pharmacies, conceivably, from continuing to dispense controlled substances. So, for example, if we were to file an appeal of the immediate revocation order,
right.
And we were to apply for a stay pending review of that order, the court may determine that it would grant that stay, but we would still be bound by the immediate suspension order.
Oh, okay. So you're saying there is a chain of events which might prevent mootness.
That's correct. And certainly we are in a situation where the order has not yet been published, and it will not become effective for 30 days, so it certainly is not moot at this point.
Yes, I understand that. And what are the delays? When do the 30 days start to run?
The 30 days, as I understand it, start to run from the time that the order is published in the Federal Register.
And when has that happened yet?
That has not happened.
Oh, I see.
When it is...
Wait a minute, I thought it was 30... Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead. What?
So it'll get published at some point. We don't know. We don't know when. And then 30 days elapse. And then it's legally effective.
That is my understanding.
Okay.
Right now, I will confess that I did not pay as much attention to that order yesterday as to preparing for this today. But as I read the order, I understand that there's sort of a blank in the order for when it becomes effective at this point. So it's 30 days from whatever, when that date is filled in.
Blank date.
Correct.
Okay. All right. Both counsel seem to feel that the jurisdictional issue that we raised was just unnecessary fussiness, since we undoubtedly have jurisdiction under something. But it doesn't seem to me it is just fussiness, because certainly our final judgment would be the different final judgments that follow from the different jurisdictional routes. One is a judgment addressing a preliminary injunction. The other is a judgment addressing an ISO, whichever way it went. So I take the jurisdictional issue seriously. I may be alone in that. But your position on it, if we put aside the last page of your brief, is in effect what?
Our position on the jurisdictional issue is that this court should have exclusive jurisdiction under 877 to review the ISO order. And the reason for that is because, as to the finding of imminent danger, that is a final decision that is made in the ISO. And even though there are continuing proceedings that may go on in the administrative process, that decision of imminent danger is never revisited in those proceedings. So that is a final determination here. And under this court's precedence in Ruckelshaus, we would suggest that it would be appropriate for the court to take jurisdiction under 877.
And do you think that we're linguistically precluded by the statutes from what looks like a more practical solution of having jurisdiction in the district court, which presumably could act more quickly than we to a challenge to an ISO, and also could gather information more easily than we could?
Certainly, and I think that's the reason that there has been such conflicting precedent on this, and you have seen so many courts actually going that direction and determining that the ISO is essentially an interlocutory or non-final decision, and therefore under the Controlled Substances Act, there would be jurisdiction in a court of competent jurisdiction to review that, which would be the district court.
It also could be us, right?
And it could be you.
It doesn't really help us, reference.
So if you were to determine and sort of agree with that line of precedent, that was an appropriate place, certainly it could go to the district court rather than here instance.
But there's no language that helps us arrive at that result, right?
At which court is more
at,
the court
at,
of competence?
At the result of saying it's in the district court, not here.
In our view, there is no language in the statute that would help you resolve that. No. Are there other questions on the jurisdictional issue? Okay. As I started, certainly CVS understands the critical role that the DEA must play in addressing issues of controlled substance abuse and diversion. And we are not challenging that they have authority to do that. What we are here to say is that in the extraordinary circumstance where DEA decides to exercise its authority to issue an immediate suspension order and to deprive a registrant from dispensing those controlled substances without any due process, that in that situation there must be an imminent danger to the public health and safety. And the ISO that was issued in this case was issued in the absence of such an imminent danger. And the administrator in issuing that order not only ignored critical information about the very effective remedial measures that these pharmacies had put into place and the drop in oxycodone that had resulted, but also took positions that were contrary
to
evidence.
Well, suppose you consider the declarations. In the declaration, the administrator explained that she had taken those into account.
She did, Your Honor, but what she said was actually striking in that she said she has essentially an agency policy of giving less weight to remedial actions. And because they are not, in Mr. Ranazizi's affidavit, not sufficiently proactive, the question of imminent danger is not whether back in the past registrants were acting appropriately or taking appropriate steps. It is what is the circumstance that exists at the time the ISO is going to be
correct.
Issued.
And she said that that in addition to that, she relied on her conclusion that even with the post-October 2011 reductions, the levels were still alarmingly high, and on the interviews with the employees, which suggested to her that the controls were not sufficient.
With regard to the conclusion that the levels were still alarmingly high, I think that Judge Brown's dissent that discusses the use of sort of average pharmacy or average purchasing data as a basis for an appropriate analysis in determining whether there has been diversion, and that was in the novelty distributors case, that analysis holds here. There are always going to be pharmacies above the average and below the average.
But 219 is so far above it that, I mean, it's not even close.
Well, actually, if you look at the record, Your Honor, by December of 2011, a full month, even a little more than a month before the ISO was issued, the amount at 219, I believe, was approximately 37,000 dosage units, or as we have in the affidavits, may round up to somewhat in the nature of 300 or so prescriptions. That is not necessarily alarming in the context of a pharmacy that has always been a busy pharmacy. And even going back to DEA's own data in 2008, when there would not have been this issue with the flood of oxycodone prescriptions to retail pharmacies, which occurred in 2010, 219 was already then significantly higher. It's a 24-hour pharmacy. It's a high-volume pharmacy. And there was no discussion in Administrator Lenhart's affidavit other than sort of the conclusory statement that it was alarming based on the fact that it was above the average to justify that decision. And certainly 5195 was almost at the average.
Yeah, I agree. That's closer. That's why I asked you about the other one.
Right.
But, you know, we're not reviewing this de novo. Right? It's we have to defer to the administrator's judgment to a certain extent here. Question is whether it's arbitrary and capricious. And, you know, she looked at all the evidence. And again, I'm talking about 219. She looked at all that evidence and concluded that when you looked at all the factors, and it was dramatically higher, there was an immediate danger.
Well, what she does say that she gave at least some consideration to those factors, but expressly says she gave them little weight simply because they occurred post issuance of the administrative inspection warrant.
I mean, I understand your argument there, but it seemed to me you overstate it because surely it's the case that some discount, I'm not saying what degree of discount, but some discount can be applied to numbers that are produced at a point where DEA is breathing very, very heavily on the pharmacy, right?
There may be some consideration for that, but what is determined can't be disregarded. It can't be disregarded, and it won't be disregarded in the administrative proceedings. And I think the critical issue here is that DEA is going to review all of the conduct, past and present, as part of its administrative proceeding. And the real question is there an imminent danger on the day that they are going to be issuing that ISO? And in that situation, it would be our position that you have to consider very strongly, and the APA requires that you consider critical information that would bear on the circumstances that exist at that time. And that information is more properly the past 3 months, where it was not simply a drop in the numbers, but as we had put forward, a new dispensing protocol that was put forward, retraining of the pharmacists, a consultants that came in to review these pharmacies, a suspension of prescribers, particular prescribers. And so there were a number of measures that would show that the controls that Administrator Lenhart is relying on were, in fact, different and reliably different because they had, in fact, resulted in a drop in oxycodone at the time that she issued the order in February.
Let me just ask you a general question, because for reasons that aren't entirely clear to me, part of the record is sealed, so the question will be general in form, and perhaps you'll explain why it is sealed. But in any event, you would acknowledge that some of the answers in the sealed parts of the record provide evidence, perhaps not substantial evidence, but evidence in support of the DEA's finding.
Certainly I don't know what's there, but I don't know that I can agree with that.
No, you do. I thought you did, because you identified things, right?
There are sealed portions that we have both sealed, and then there are portions that were withheld on privilege and are also sealed. And so those, I certainly don't know what's in
those portions. Those are sealed
from
you. Oh, I see.
Right.
Now, I'm talking about only the ones that are sealed in the court filings.
There are statements in there that are relied on by DEA, I believe, in order to support its conclusion. But the problem with that is that a number of the statements that they choose to rely on, and we know these are the ones they relied on because these are the ones they put forward in the litigation affidavits of Administrator Lenhart and Mr. Ranazizi, that they are taken out of context. And what is left out of a look at that evidence is all of the very positive things that are contained in the statements of the pharmacists that show that they were, in fact, taking steps over and above what may be required to review the prescription.
What if we look at the total thing, and let's accept your proposition that, I mean, they obviously, it's perfectly clear that they left out a lot of context. That could not be clearer. But suppose we say, well, an agency looking at the total thing, including things that they don't particularly mention in the litigation affidavit, could conclude that there was an imminent danger. Even though it hasn't, in other words, this would be something that in the normal form of review of agency decisions, we might remand for clearer analysis, I mean, under State Farm.
Right. And I recognize that in the way that this particular case developed on its procedural posture, that we now have the benefit of affidavits as well as the administrative record, so there's no real reason to remand for further review. However, we submit that even when you take all of that information, what it does not establish is an imminent danger at the time. And even though the administrator suggests and reaches the conclusion that diversion, quote, could be ongoing, that is not the type of threat to immediate threat to the public health and safety, that it could be ongoing, possibly, even though there's been a tremendous drop in oxycodone dispensing and a huge retraining and change in mindset of these pharmacies. That is not the type of finding that justifies depriving someone of due process and taking their property without that due process.
All right, we'll give you a couple minutes to reply. Ms. Hybus.
Thanks very much, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Samantha Heifetz for the United States. Now, with the Court's permission, I would start with the jurisdictional issues that have been flagged. It is our view that the Court...
Could you first talk about the mootness potential here?
Yes, Your Honor. It is our view that, as has been noted, the order that the DEA administrator issued concludes by stating that the order becomes effective 30 days following publication in the Federal Register. It was anticipated that that publication would take place this Friday, but the parties have agreed, or rather the administrator has agreed with the plaintiff, Holiday CVS, to withhold publication, to give them a week to make any requests for redactions that they might care to submit. Those will be considered, and then publication will take place. We do believe that once that happens, once publication occurs, 30 days pass, and the administrator's order becomes effective, at that point the registrations are revoked. Once the registrations are revoked, it obviously raises the question of what effect an immediate suspension order could have. And in that circumstance, in other cases, the Norman Bridges case in the Fifth Circuit and in the Novelty case in this court back in 2008, at that point, once the DEA administrator's order has become effective, the courts of appeals have held the ISO proceedings moot. At that point,
point that Ms. O'Neill made about the possibility of a stay of the revocation order?
So we certainly think that the at that point there the direct review provision applies to the final order. So the plaintiff would come to this court seeking, if they were to seek review, they would have 30 days to petition for direct review, and they might ask for a stay. We would urge that a stay would be inappropriate for a variety of reasons. Obviously, the validity of the decision, but we would also urge that that language that she pointed to, yes, Your Honor, in 824D, suggests that Congress did not envision that registrants would be able to continue to provide or dispense controlled substances during the pendency of judicial review. But we would say that the court's review of that would happen in the context of that request for a stay, and that there wouldn't be a need for separate proceedings. So this court would...
What she said is that if we did issue such a stay, then in fact the ISO would still be, would not only still be of legal effect, but would be a real legal effect because it would be the only thing in effect.
No, we appreciate that, Your Honor, and we do certainly think that it speaks to Congress's anticipation, but what we've previously told this court and the Fifth Circuit is that much in the way that a final order overtakes a preliminary injunction, and the preliminary injunction doesn't have continuing effect, that here, effectively, the orders would merge insofar as the effect preventing them from dispensing would be that they no longer have a registration that's been issued by DEA, that it's been revoked. That's right. So if this court is of the view that we would be able to rely upon the immediate suspension order at that point, then we would agree, Your Honor, that the case would not be moot. But if this court were of the view that at that time, as occurred in Novelty and in Norman Bridges, that the immediate suspension order no longer has its own separate effect once registrations have been revoked by the administrator, then we would conclude that mootness applies here as it did there.
So if I'm understanding what you're saying, a hypothetical stay of the registration revocation would enable the pharmacies to sell.
That is certainly what would have happened had a stay been issued in Novelty or in Norman Bridges, yes, Your Honor. Of course, at that point, we would make arguments as to why a stay was inappropriate and probably make reference to 824D because of the extent to which it conveys Congress's anticipation that such stays would not issue. Now, I'm happy to turn to the merits, but if we would want to address other jurisdictional points, we can do that as well. I would point out, with the permission of the court, that I think there's an important distinction here between this case and the Ruckelhaus case that opposing counsel points to. That case is a direct review case where the court was looking at finality, but the direct review provision there simply applied to any order. The direct review provision at issue here in 877 in the Controlled Substances Act doesn't simply say any order. It uses additional language. It talks about final decisions. It places a great emphasis on finality. And so, as we discuss in our supplemental filing, we do think, going to a question I think Judge Williams posed earlier, that there is a linguistic basis on which to conclude that here, APA jurisdiction in the district court was the correct way to proceed. So I would suggest
that seems to involve a sort of expressive bias argument on stilts. That is to say, the statute doesn't say the only thing reviewable under 877 is a revocation order, right? It clearly applies to a revocation order.
That is correct.
So why shouldn't it apply to other final orders the way it's worded?
So what we've noted is that when one looks at 824, which provides for the immediate suspensions, the language there tells us something about, or seems to have a natural reading that suggests that Congress was anticipating that there might be different courts reviewing immediate suspension orders and the final revocation. And there's a great emphasis on the distinction between the interim nature of the immediate suspension order and the nature of the final order. And so, as our supplemental brief suggests, we think that taken on the whole, the better reading would be an understanding that there is room here to distinguish between where an ISO should go for review and where a final revocation order would go. And that distinction is not at odds with Ruckelhaus. But I'm happy to turn to the merits if there are no questions on the jurisdictional points. Because when we get to the merits, what we see here is a very strong story about why DEA felt compelled to issue the two immediate suspension orders that are challenged in this case. Plaintiff has, yes?
The novelty decision was out when all this went on, right? So to the extent that people at the DEA were totally ignorant about rudimentary statistics, they got an education, right? An education in time for their addressing this case, right?
The novelty decision was certainly out before this right. Before these events, yes.
And yet, so far as I can make out, the order is drafted without the slightest confrontation of what Judge Brown said and what her colleagues said.
Well, Judge Brown's dissent was focused, I mean, there we're dealing with a revocation order and concerns about reliance or sole reliance on national averages. And that's not at all what this case is about.
It's not sole reliance, and that was what Judge Brown's colleagues relied on, the other factors. We have other factors here.
Absolutely.
But the order talks as if there was some sort of powerful evidence in what DEA found in terms of the numbers. And it's not rudimentary. There's no effort to hold other things constant. There's no identification of a standard deviation. It's the crudest thing I've ever seen.
And I think it goes to what the role of the numbers actually played here, which is that these weren't being used as some bedrock of the ISO, and it wasn't the thing that was being solely or even uniquely relied upon. It's the beginning of the narrative. Sorry, Aaron, I didn't mean to.
But, I mean, to even rely on it except as a throwaway line, given the junk status of the numbers, seems to me shameful is the word that comes to my mind about it.
Well, I was going to say, Your Honor, that in terms of what role I think the numbers did play here, let me just lay out for you what I think that is on behalf of DEA. Okay, the numbers were a big part. The volume of oxycodone at issue here was a big part of what triggered this investigation and the analysis in the first instance. Okay, so ARCOS numbers were reported to DEA having to do with CVS's distributor. An investigation was began, and it led DEA to recognize the tremendous volume of oxycodone that was continuing to flow to these particular stores. So the numbers played a big role because they stood out. And what's amazing about this is that they stood out in Florida, a part of the country that stands out among the national average. So actually, as we discuss in our brief, the comparison that was done here...
Do we know that the Florida standing out gets the national average is based on abuse?
Well,
Florida,
there has, yes,
Florida
exactly.
Abuse.
Yeah.
More than the rest of us?
That is correct, Your Honor. It appears to be that Florida, it is to say, and I'm not, this is no denigration of Floridians, but that there has been a so-called pill mill epidemic in Florida that has been the subject of significant law enforcement attention, legislative change, and DEA attention. So there was a marked and documented issue of oxycodone abuse in conjunction with other controlled substances. It is discussed at length in the declaration. The deputy of DEA's Office of Diversion Control, Mr. Ranazizi, goes on, devotes a portion of his declaration, to be sure, to discussing the context and concerns about Florida-wide. And those concerns led to meetings between DEA and CVS back in December 2010 and August 2011. So it was well known that there was a wide problem in Florida and that it was affecting the totals generally, and these stores nonetheless stood out. So the numbers played a role in triggering the investigation. And then what we see is that even after they're well aware that the investigation has begun, those numbers are still high. And the magnitude of those numbers is relevant to imminent danger, not because even necessarily of some specific statistical variation or deviation from the norm, but because it of course speaks to the fact that we have a basis for, it contributes to real concern. Look, if we had a small pharmacy.
You're assuming the conclusion, though. You're assuming that the some significant portion of the high number, high by reference to we don't know what, is abusive.
Precisely, Your Honor. And the evidence for that is tremendous. And it's not about numbers. That's where we look to the interviews with the staff themselves, with the pharmacists in charge and the lead technicians and the staff who work for them. So the point that I'm trying to make is that that evidence is there, and it doesn't come from the numbers. It comes from the words of the personnel of these stores themselves. And what the numbers tell us is that, you know, what the interviews tell us is that we were dealing with stores that were not properly dispensing controlled substances. The pharmacist in charge at store 5195, Jessica Merrill, talks, says numerous things in her investigatory report that make very clear that she was aware, and this is happening when she knows she's being investigating. She's talking to a DEA investigator, and she concedes that she had to save oxycodone for her real patients, her real pain patients, that she, when questioned as to the legitimacy of the prescriptions that she was filling, she acknowledges that probably there were illegitimate prescriptions when, for example, a car would pull up through the drive-through and multiple people in the same car would turn over prescriptions from the same doctor for the same quantities of oxycodone and related cocktail drugs, the muscle relaxant and the anti-anxiety medication. They would have the same diagnostic codes, everyone apparently claiming lumbar pain. You know, so it's those...
Lumbar pain probably is a very common source of need for...
That may be, but these are prescribing patterns that Jessica Merrill, in her interview, acknowledged that she recognized that they were seeing the same amounts of medicine being requested over and over, that they were seeing, and that these were the very patterns that DEA had earlier discussed with CVS officials from these stores as being red flags that the pharmacists at these stores ought to be concerned about.
Yeah, I understand that argument about store 219, where during the post-October period, the quantity, even if you're right about the quantity, setting aside, even if you're right that the quantity data is helpful, you don't have that for store 5195. That's pretty close to the state average, and I think the record shows that there were 1,000 stores during that period of time in the state with higher quantity, right?
Absolutely, Your Honor. The point dovetails perfectly with my response to Judge Williams, which is that this is not just about the numbers. Now, the numbers were still above the national average.
There are no numbers for 5195.
No, we do have numbers for that period. We know that...
No, I know, but my point is they're slightly over the state average, and we know there's many stores with more.
So right there we have, you know, roughly 9,000 units going out. Well, 9,000 units is still a lot of oxycodone, okay? And so the point I was hoping to make earlier is this, I think is responsive to your question, which is that if we were dealing with a corner pharmacy where their practices were improper, they were not maintaining the verification procedures, the reporting to DEA, everything that they were supposed to be doing, maybe there would have been lesser measures that could have been taken because we're only talking about 100 units a month going out. But 9,000 units is relevant to the imminent danger analysis here because it does speak to the fact that even if these guys were no longer the number one, number two in the state of all the CVS stores in the state of Florida, they're still doing a big business in oxycodone. And the biggest point here is that they can talk all they want about how the numbers came down. Let's talk about all the things that had not changed. The personnel at these stores had not changed. The same pharmacists in charge, the same technicians, the same staff pharmacists who were interviewed by DEA investigators and gave these appalling answers, talking, for example, in the case of store 219 about everything really turning on there being an established relationship with the customer. So if a customer came in, an established relationship meaning only that that person had been obtaining their oxycodone at that store for some period of time, if that person with a long-standing relationship with the store came in with a friend and the friend had a similar prescription for oxycodone, it would be filled because the person came in with a known entity. That is not the normal way in which dispensing of controlled substance pharmaceuticals is supposed to work, yet that was the statement of the pharmacist in charge of that store. And we've already talked about many of the statements that Jessica Merrill, the pharmacist in charge at store 5195, made. The point is that...
Is there sort of know your customer rule in this matter equivalent to the one for the SEC, that the SEC imposes on brokers and their customers?
I am not familiar with the SEC.
One of the people interviewed said, I would hate to withhold the medicine from someone who really needed it. That seems to me a serious concern, which I don't see playing any role whatever in the DEA's approach to this.
That's at the core of the DEA's approach. The DEA's point is that it is the job of the pharmacist to figure out which are the valid prescription. That is exactly what this case is about. So it's statements like Jessica Merrill's when she says, it's not my job to judge the prescription, or the individual who works for her who says, the pharmacist there who says that she's not there to police the patients. Okay, these are quotes from the statements that they gave to DEA investigators, and that is very much the point. It is their job to police the prescriptions. That is the unchallenged responsibility.
They have both a right and a duty to, within their discretion, say, nothing for you.
That is correct. They have the authority to call DEA, to report these matters to DEA, and to refuse prescriptions to individuals. It's not just their response. It's not just their authority, but it is in fact their fundamental responsibility under the Controlled Substances Act. And that has not been challenged here. Nobody disputes the fact that the way the Controlled Substances Act tries to ensure that we don't see diversion, that is, drugs moving into illicit channels, is by charging each person along the supply chain with responsibilities. And there's no question that the pharmacies and the pharmacists have a corresponding responsibility under federal law to ensure that the prescriptions that they fill are lawful, that they are for legitimate medical use, and that they were issued in the proper professional course, in the usual professional course. And it is that responsibility that was violated here. That's what there was evidence of from the investigation, the long-term investigation that DEA did. It's on that basis that the administrator has now issued the final order, ultimately revoking their registrations. So absolutely, Your Honor, that is precisely what the case is about.
On the, Steve, were you done? Yeah, on the quantity question, I'm curious about why you haven't brought to our attention this agency declaration at Joint Appendix 122, which compares the two stores to two nearby stores. Is there something wrong with that declaration? Is there some reason why we shouldn't?
No. Your Honor, we've made the point at various times that there is evidence in the declarations that contextualizes the information. There's comparisons.
Is that what you're referring to?
Well, no, not just this. Right. There's also comparisons to the average dosage units that Cardinal Health was providing to other Florida pharmacies. You'll see additional data of this nature out from 119, JA 119 to 120, not just 121 to 122. And of course, the comparison to local pharmacies, I will note again that the Sanford area has, and Florida in general, as we discussed earlier, has a much higher average than the national average. So for example, in 2010, the average dosing per unit in Florida was 134,000. Nationally, it was under 70,000. And as a result, Florida has passed legislation specifically targeting the so-called pill mills, et cetera. There has also been additional investigation. CVS is not the only set of stores, pharmacies in Florida that have been the target of DEA investigations because of diversion issues. So there's recently been a significant investigation related to Walgreens, and that's public information. For example, DEA...
Are you answering his question?
Well, yes, because the paragraph that he's referencing is about local comparisons. So I just want to contextualize it a bit more broadly.
I want to ask you about your filing on Friday and the footnote advising us of the status of this case, where you advise us that the ALJ issued his decision in June.
That's right, Your Honor.
And that, quote, it is expected that an order will be issued by the end of September. I have a couple questions about that. I'm curious about why we weren't told about the ALJ's decision and the exceptions, and that it was pending a lot earlier than that.
The ALJ's decision, oh, sorry, Your Honor, is that
yeah,
the...
And I'm also wondering why, I mean, why, under what circumstances was that sentence written on Friday? Did you not know that this decision was coming out on Monday, or, you know, had your client not told you? What was going on?
Yes, Your Honor. So the ALJ's decision is not considered a public document until or unless it is published along with, as part of the administrator's decision. The administrator's decision is a public document.
So is that why we weren't advised of it?
Well, I believe actually, I'm going to double check this, but I thought that it was actually mentioned likewise in a footnote. But I can confirm.
Maybe it was. Maybe I missed it.
The ALJ's decision did come down in June, and there was a period for response, but it's not considered to be a completion of the administrative process.
Yeah, you must realize there are ways of filing things with this court in camera that would keep the confidence, right?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
And now what about my other question about the circumstances of this sentence?
So that was based only upon, and it references by citation, an earlier statement that had been made about what the projected timing of the process is, how long these things take. And that sentence just reflected the fact that I anticipated that we were not off course.
Did you not know on Friday that this was coming out on Monday?
That is correct.
Did your client not know that the oral argument was today?
Well, my dealings with DEA have been with the chief counsel's office up until this decision came out yesterday exclusively. And the chief counsel's office considered itself to have a pending matter before the administrator in the form of this pending administrative proceeding. And so they did not consider it appropriate for us to be inquiring about the status. We made an early inquiry about just what the general timeline would look like, but we weren't in regular contact with the legal advisor, or we weren't in contact at all, to be frank, with the legal advisor to the administrator. And so it was that office that put this decision out.
I actually find this very disturbing. You know, had we had better information from the Justice Department and the DEA about this, you know, we might have reconsidered hearing this case today. We might have asked for briefing on this question of mootness. Maybe some of us might not have had to spend the weekend preparing for the case. I guess I think we'd like to get from the assistant AG in charge of the civil division an explanation of how this happened. We'd like to know in writing in the next couple of days, you know, why it was that we weren't kept up to date about developments and what the division thinks its responsibility is to keep panels of this court up to date on significant changes in cases that it's about to hear. Okay?
Yes, Your Honor.
And I think we'd like to have that maybe like within a week.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
You understand our concern?
I think I do. Let me just repeat back what I understand to be the focus of the letter to make sure that I'm accurately understanding it. From the AAG who leads the civil division, a discussion of what we understand to be our responsibilities to keep the panel up to date about developments in the case. and what the timeline or how things unfolded in this matter.
And particularly how this sentence, we expect it to occur by the end of the month when, I mean, somebody, either in the Justice Department or the agency, must have known at that point that this thing was going to come out on Monday.
Well, no one at the Justice Department in the Civil Division had that information.
Well, then that's a good and answer, within, but the question then is why?
Well, Your Honor, just noting, and obviously this will be better reflected in a letter, but just I can offer what I do know to be true, which is that our contact has been with the Chief Counsel's office that was responsible for putting together the issuance of the ISO.
Maybe,
and there is hesitation to have...
Maybe the Justice Department needs to remind its clients that when they have a case pending in the D.C. Circuit, they need to keep the Justice Department up to date on developments so that the Justice Department can decide which information to supply to the panel and whatnot.
We appreciate that, Your Honor, and we will certainly do so.
Do you share your submissions with your client?
Could you repeat that, Your Honor?
Do you share your submissions with your client?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
The EA saw this sentence.
They would know that on Friday.
They would have seen that sentence.
Yes, Your Honor, they saw that on Friday.
They never called you and said, whoops, you know, Ms. Heifetz, I need to tell you, it's not the end of the month. It's coming out 24 hours before the oral argument.
Well, Your Honor,
And the D.C. Circuit might be quite surprised at that. They didn't call you and tell you that?
Again, the individuals with whom I was in contact, so, of course, I'm not sending it just simply to DEA at large, but to specific individuals at DEA, and those individuals were in the Chief Counsel's office, and they were not privy to the Administrator's office's timeline for this decision. And so, unfortunately, the individuals with whom we established contact for the purposes of this case lacked that information. And our expectation about September...
Maybe my request should include a little bit of discussion about what the DE legal counsel's office thinks its responsibilities are also. Maybe the assistant AG should consult with him also in writing the letter.
We will do so, Your Honor. Absolutely. But I hope that I've answered the question. The statement about the expectation that it would come out at the end of the month was merely referencing back to a statement long ago discussed in our opening brief, reflected in declaration statements that were made in the district court about how long the process in general was expected to take.
You understood my question about that. The circumstances have changed dramatically since then.
I do. And so I just wanted to be clear that I, unfortunately, was merely relying on that prior knowledge.
It's not a particularly satisfactory response.
Oh, absolutely, Your Honor. I just didn't want to be misleading the court in any way. So we'll try to offer up a more satisfactory answer in a letter. But for now, you at least have the facts as I have them.
All right. Thank you. How much time does Ms. O'Neill have? All right. Take a minute.
Thank you, Your Honors. Very quickly, I would also note that the DEA Administrator's order was signed on August 31, even though it was delivered to us yesterday. The question that was asked with regard to the other evidence that may have been in the record that put the quantity evidence in context, I think I would make two statements about that. First of all, it is broken down into the evidence of certain doctors who had DEA action against them. And if you look at the record, it's very clear that all of that was in 2010 and that we had, in fact, ceased dispensing to most of those doctors before 2010. Mm-hmm. And as to Ms. Merrill's statements, she was very clear that the reason that she set limits and approached her dispensing the way she did was so that she could engage in precisely the type of due diligence that the government is asking her to do. She said it was so time-consuming to do that she needed to limit the amount of customers that she would deal with regard to Oxy on a day. And so the imminent danger did not exist in February. The critical issue here is that DEA treated this immediate suspension order, which is an extreme measure, as it treats any of its other authorities, and it cannot be constitutionally permissible without the actual showing of imminent harm in this case to issue the immediate suspension order.
All right, thank you.